American science historian Eric Conway has examined some of the major issues of the last 4 or 5 decades and concluded that a number of scientists and scientific advisers have deliberately campaigned to mislead the public and influence politicians. Conway tracks the debates on smoking, acid rain, climate change, the ozone hole, and even DDT, and finds some of the same individuals surfacing in the denial camp again and again. In a book Conway has co-authored with Naomi Oreskes called Merchants of Doubt, these individuals are named and identified by Conway as right-wing libertarians who regard environmentalists as regulation-hungry socialists. Thus, Conway argues, politics have corrupted the public understanding of major scientific issues. Eric Conway joins me now. That kind of summarises the book, does it? Do you think that's fair?
I think that's fair enough.
All right, to get your drift, let's go to the introduction of the book. Who was Ben Santer and what happened to him?
Ben Santer was and still is a scientist at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory outside San Francisco. His job as a scientist is doing a particular kind of climate study known as fingerprinting, comparing statistically the outputs of climate models to observational data to determine whether the sign, the fingerprint of anthropogenic or human-caused global warming is really present.
And this is kind of crucial. I mean, fingerprinting is the touch word at the moment. When people say, yeah, yeah, but how do you know whether it's natural or whether it's anthropogenic?
That's precisely right.
This is how we can do
precisely
it.
Precisely right. The whole idea of a fingerprint is the attribution of the cause of the warming. We know the warming is happening, but there are several possible causes. It could be increased solar output, or it could be greenhouse gases. Those two different warming causes create a different pattern of warming in the atmosphere. And so what Ben's job was to figure out whether the human signal, the greenhouse gas signal, was in the data or some other signal.
Mm-hmm. So there he is, toiling away at his job. What happens?
What happens is that he becomes the coordinating lead author for the detection and attribution chapter, the fingerprinting chapter, in the 1995 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change study.
Henceforth to be called IPCC.
IPCC, the second assessment report, the SAR. And having written the chapter and having it put through all the various sort levels of review that goes through, when it's published, he comes under attack from a group of scientists associated with an institute, from the George C. Marshall Institute in Washington.
About whom we will hear more later.
More later, yep. And those attacks were written with an argument that he had deleted uncertainty and made the fingerprint studies look more certain than they were. And those kinds of attacks went on for months, and the IPCC eventually had to try to defend him, and so did the American Meteorological Society.
And so, in the end, who won that argument?
That depends on your definition of the word victory.
That's exactly
Ben
right.
Ben Santer is probably even more highly regarded now than he was then. He was quite a young and early career scientist at that time in 1905. In the scientific community, Ben no question won. In the public eye, the problem is a little more difficult because the idea of those attacks was to create doubt about the credibility of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and about climate science itself.
Why don't you regard those attacks as part of a robust debate around a scientific method?
Debates in science are carried out in scientific journals. They're not carried out by op-eds in the Wall Street Journal.
But why can't they be? I mean, scientists have been hell-bent on popularizing science. Why can't everybody have a go?
Of course, everyone has the right to have those kinds of opinions, but the question becomes, is it still science if it's being carried out on op-ed pages? Naomi and I would say, well, not really, because there's no standard of evidence for op-eds, at least not in the United States. You can say essentially anything you want without any evidence. In science, you can't. In science, you have to have evidence backing your position. And so those kinds of debates that go on in scientific journals have to be backed up by evidence.
The punchline in the Ben Santa story, however, is that a few years later, he notices that the very same guys who had attacked him had been involved in the program organized by the tobacco industry to discredit scientific evidence linking tobacco to cancer. So a kind of penny dropped for him. Who were these guys? Who were Fred Seitz and Fred Singer?
Fred Seitz and Fred Singer were both very respected American physicists at one point. Seitz was a solid-state physicist, and Singer was a geophysicist interested in cosmic ray studies, one of the original rocket scientists. And both of them retired and took up as their retirement careers, really, helping to fend off regulation of tobacco products, and quite successfully.
Both worked for the tobacco industry. Both had a Cold War background, as it were. And both of them went on to other arguments in one respect or another. I mean, there was the acid rain argument. And before that, there was... what was the other one? DDT, I suppose.
Oh, acid rain, secondhand smoke, ozone depletion, and climate change were their major issues, yeah.
And you can see their names coming up in each of those debates.
Oh, yes. I want to be a little careful. Fred Seitz worked directly for the tobacco industry. Singer always worked somewhat removed. He worked via think tanks who received funding from the tobacco industries and others.
The George C. Marshall Institute was set up in the first instance. Exactly why?
It was actually set up for a completely different reason. In 1984, the Marshall Institute was actually set up to defend President Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, more colloquially known as Star Wars, the idea that we could build this big anti-ballistic missile system in space to defend us from the Soviet Union, which was coming under attack from scientists affiliated with the Union of Concerned Scientists, from Carl Sagan, the famous astronomer, and others. Sagan organized a campaign against the SDI system and a petition drive to get other scientists to refuse to take SDI funding. The Marshall Institute was set up, again, to defend SDI from this assault by the majority of other American physicists, really.
Who did Sagan think he was? I mean, you know, just pause for a moment. Mm-hmm. In your book, it does appear as if you're a libertarian, anti-regulation person, then you're a bad guy. And if you're a pro-regulation, vaguely environmental, left-wing kind of person, you're a good guy. Well, Sagan arguably kicked off the whole politicization of science. Would you not say that?
Oh, I think the politicization of science goes back much further than that, because remember, our tobacco story starts in the 50s. Sagan comes up in SDI in the mid-80s. Things were already well along. What we argue with the SDI story is SDI, for one thing, is not a scientific project. It's a big engineering program. And because it was notional, in the sense, or maybe theoretical is a better word for it, one could never prove one way or the other whether SDI would actually work without having built the thing. So one could have legitimate arguments over it, and both sides were arguing from political positions.
That's right.
Okay. Sagan was an arms controller. He thought it was far more sane to limit the number of nuclear weapons, period, and not go embark in these endless arms races. Our actors at the Marshall Institute didn't believe in arms control. They didn't believe in big international treaties. Again, that's a political view. It's a well-established one. And our goal wasn't to make Sagan a hero and our guys demons, certainly not in that chapter, because the outcome of that was extremely unclear. In a lot of ways, both sides did some wrong things. Sagan exaggerated.
Well, that's what I mean,
SDI.
Really. I mean, there he was the pop star of the scientific world, and he was going outside his area of expertise.
Indeed. And
right,
so were
into
our
politics.
Gentlemen. And so were our gentlemen.
Well, you know, and it was a mutually assured destruction in many ways. Then the destruction was going to be of science.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody's culpable of that, presumably.
Yes.
I mean, as you point out, the right-wing turn against science began. But it was a left-wing turn in response to the right-wing term. Do you know what I mean? It was a it takes two.
It took both sides.
All right.
Indeed.
Singer and Zeitz then believed that left-wing activists had taken over American mainstream science.
Indeed, they did.
And they felt this because they'd been through the Cold War and they felt that they were being undermined and SDI was being undermined. And this was their mindset, you're saying, when they went on to other campaigns, which also ultimately involved a question of regulation.
Yes.
So were they arguing things that they didn't believe in order to avoid the worst evil of regulation? Is that what you're saying?
No. They were true believers.
All right.
All right. One of the realities One of the realities of very strongly held beliefs is that they can cause you to disregard facts that don't comport with those beliefs. All right. And what you could see happening in Bill Nirenberg's papers as he became more and more involved with this group.
William Nirenberg and Robert Jastrow, indeed, are another two physicists that worked on and off with Fred Zeitz and Fred Singer over the years on these campaigns.
That's right.
And Nirenberg was involved in acid rain primarily, wasn't he?
He was involved in acid rain and climate. Nirenberg was the founder of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography's climate program, and one of the big ironies of our story. As he retired in 1984 and became involved in the Marshall Institute, you can see in his papers his drift away from what the scientific evidence said about climate change, so that he started from what I consider a reasonable position, if a rather lowballing one, in 1983. By the late 1990s, he's convinced himself through this process that it's all bunk. It was actually depressing to see that happen in someone's papers, but the idea was that he was, you asked me if they were knowingly misrepresenting things, and I think the answer to that is I don't think so. They were deluded by their own political beliefs into rejecting, to ignoring all the evidence that they're wrong.
Is there a possibility, did you think about the possibility when you were writing this book, that you could have written it from the other side as well?
Oh, I'm sure if I went back and took, for example, Greenpeace's studies of nuclear power over the last 40 years, I can make a pretty similar argument.
Yeah.
Could I do it, though, if I had gone with the Marshall Institute's mirror image, the Union of Concerned Scientists? I'm not so sure. Understand that the UCS was founded for in 1969 to shoot down the earlier edition of the anti-ballistic missile system, again, for a pretty political reason. And they made themselves a science-based nonprofit to make that set of arguments. But again, could I do it with them? I'm not so sure. My understanding of their role in climate science has been that they've been pretty positive and they've stuck pretty close to what the evidence says, where the Marshall Institute drifted far away.
I mean, certainly the most compelling part of your book, because it's inarguable, is their defense, Zeitz and Singer, at one degree of separation or other, their defense of the tobacco industry and the tobacco industry attack on the Environmental Protection Authority, because with the wisdom of hindsight, it looks just disgusting. I mean, they are deliberately trying to persuade people that smoking won't kill them. And that can't ever be justified on any scientific ground whatsoever. Their work on acid rain to some extent, Nirenberg, and the climate change issue is murkier because the argument is not solved. You say it is solved, but for a lot of people, it is not solved. Now, do the people who think that is not solved, are they automatically right-wing libertarian ideologues? I don't think so. I think some of them are genuinely thoughtful people.
I think a great many people, certainly in the United States, have been misled by the doubt-mongering campaigns.
But this is going to drive your average skeptic out there crazy.
Of course it will.
Because misled? How dare you patronize me? I've done my reading, I've done my research, and I don't think that they've proved their point that it's not natural climate change. You know the arguments. Mm-hmm. And you know that they all believe that they've done their homework.
They all believe that they've done their homework. So did Fred Singer. So did, he still does believe it. So did Fred Seitz and so on. They believed that they were right. How can you prove that someone with these beliefs is wrong? Well, to be honest, I largely think that you can't overcome that, because by the way you've chosen to define the skeptics, people who are simply not convinced despite 30 years of evidence, you know, they probably are ideologues. And no amount of evidence will convince them. I mean, that's what's so sad about the story.
Tragedy.
All right, that's the tragedy
of the
story. The
polarization of it all.
It's become extremely polarized. So,
what about the Climate Gate emails, the so-called Climate Gate emails? Don't people say to you, look here, that proves that there are egregious faults on both sides, that the pro-global warming people have revealed their bias and they have over-egged the pudding in response to the criticism? That's not proper science, is it? What's your interpretation of that?
Oh, I think the Climate Gate emails simply show me that scientists are human. The mistake that people...
But how low? You can't. Scientists you agree with are human. Mm-hmm. Scientists you don't agree with are egregious.
Oh, but we've never called them egregious. What I said was that they fell prey to groupthink, which is a human tendency.
But how do you know that the scientists involved, even peripherally or directly in the Climate Gate emails, weren't also involved in groupthink, afflicted by groupthink, IPCC mm-hmm. groupthink? You know I have to say this to you.
Of course you
What's
do.
What's the answer?
The answer from our point of view, you know, Naomi and I came to this as outsiders. We don't belong to IPCC. We're not climate scientists.
All right, but let me ask you this. Does your belief that climate change is a real problem, and you do believe that climate change is a real problem, among many other people, needing global action, does that belief stem from your study of the science or from your natural antipathy to the merchants of doubt that you see as dishonest in the past?
No, it comes from study of the science. I didn't actually discover the denial campaign until long after I'd started working in the history of climate science.
Because that's an important point.
That's right. And so to answer your question, people have made a great deal about this Climate Gate thing and the whole hockey stick mess that has been going on now for 10 years. The reality, though, is that's one small piece of evidence. And there are dozens and dozens of other pieces. The one I think is most compelling is actually ocean temperature data. There are no cities in the ocean, so you can't bias that data from the urban heat island effect. And it can, because the oceans hold more than 80% of the heat in the climate system, a minor variation in the atmosphere can't affect it. That ocean temperature data has been available since 1999 and shows a strong warming over the last half century.
You're very critical of the media continuing to regard global warming as a debate. And indeed, I mean, let me share this with you. A recent communication, New Zealand climate change skeptic, emailed me a piece by a fellow skeptic that you're obviously familiar with, called Roy Spencer, mm-hmm. insisting that climate change is natural, claiming the IPCC group suppresses evidence, pointing to, yes, the Climate Gate emails. Another person responded to that, telling the original sender, quote, "It's a complete waste of time sending this to Kim Hill. She's not interested. I've emailed Radio New Zealand a few times before, asking why they persist in pushing global warming alarmism while completely ignoring the other side of the issue, ignoring the hundreds of sceptical scientists and academics who would argue the opposite to global warming, damned media who stick like limpets to the doom and disaster self, sick to the back teeth of hearing the Flannery Oreskes, your co-author, mm-hmm. Holdren types bleating about some non-existent man-made climate catastrophe. Everyone knows it's bollocks except them." Now, I get this a lot. And as a member of the media, mm-hmm. one feels obliged to cover both sides of the argument, especially when there are scientists involved in the other side who say that groupthink is being done on the part of the IPCC, and the debate is not over. The debate is not over. What do you say to that?
What do I say to that? We argue that the members of the media should learn to assess the credibility of the speakers when you're writing about science and reporting on science.
I mean, if we had to check the credibility of speakers, we'd have no one on the radio.
But that's a fundamental
part
of the problem.
Everybody these days has an opinion.
Of course, but everyone always has had an opinion. And the question is, how do we as a society decide whose opinions have merit?
Well, okay, call it a cop out. Mm-hmm. But what the media tends to do is say, "Here's this person. Have a listen. What do you think?" Mm-hmm. You don't think that's good enough?
I don't think that's good enough if you're reporting on issues of important science. Now, I do want to say one thing though. We keep being called alarmists. I'm not an alarmist. I think the climate problem is easy to fix. But you have to get on with fixing it. And our problem in the United States anyways, I know New Zealand's made much more progress than we have. The problem in the United States is we're still arguing over science that was some scientific issues that were settled a couple of decades ago, and therefore not having the debate we should be having over what to do about the problem.
I wonder if the heat, this is repeating an earlier question, I suppose, in another way, if the heat generated by this debate, whether it be global warming or whether it be DDT and whether it should have been banned by the United States or not, comes down to if you see regulation as such a bad thing, then you will argue any which way not to have it because regulation is the worst thing.
That's
right.
That's ideology in action. Yes.
So, but that's not necessarily. I mean, if it was left-wing ideology, would you be averse to that as well?
Oh, yes. So, and as I said before, any strongly held set of beliefs will tend to lead you away from evidence that doesn't support those beliefs.
But if it's a battle between regulation versus unrestricted commercial activity, which essentially is what you define it as, that's the environmental argument today. Science can't tell us which is the best way to go, right?
No, science can only tell us that there are these environmental problems. What it can't do is tell us the one best way to resolve those problems.
I mean, for example, Singer, as you say, pushed for a market-based solution to acid rain.
Right, while simultaneously denying the need to deal with acid rain. That was the trick. But you're quite right. There are market-based solutions to a number of different kinds of environmental problems. The U.S. did actually implement an acid rain emissions trading scheme. It was expected to reduce acid rain emissions by about 25%. It actually reduced it 54% over about 10 years. The implementation cost was 1/10 of what was expected. So that was a hugely successful program from that standpoint. And that's one of the reasons why the U.S. carbon policy initiatives, we don't actually have one, has been towards an ETS, an emissions trading scheme. And it's one of the reasons that other countries have also gone that route too. It was a market-friendly policy. But it's not the only kind of policy, and science by itself anyway can't say one way or another whether that's the best approach or whether a more regulatory command and control sort of approach is the best.
Can you see any way to breaking this political standoff, if you like, to deprive the two camps of their ideology and make it about science again? I can't see that happening. Can you?
I can't either, which is one of the things that makes me depressed about the whole story. What I'd love to see in my perfect fantasy world would be more people interested in actually looking at all the evidence, because that's what you just don't see anymore, even amongst some of the scientists. There has become more advocacy for all sides than perhaps there should be. I'd like to see scientists, mainstream scientists, talk more about their values as individuals and their goals, but I'd also like to see them stay the heck out of policy, because too many of the leading scientists believe what's sometimes called the linear model of science policy interaction. That is, once the science is known, the policy follows directly from the science. And I've said that's not true. There are many possible ways of dealing with a problem. And so I'd like to see scientists get out of policy advocacy. And I think that would reduce, though it wouldn't eliminate, some of the polarization, I think.
Mm. It all comes back. It comes back to Carl Sagan.
Mm-hmm.
He was wrong to do that. He inserted himself into a debate that he had no right to be as a scientist, using his cred in that way.
I think that's right. You can take the idea of the social responsibility of a scientist too far. What Sagan did was go outside the norms of the scientific community in order to attack SDI. As a citizen, that's his right. As a scientist, that put him at odds with a variety of other norms that scientists are supposed to have.
By writing this book, though, don't you risk politicizing science even further? By encouraging people to think that everybody who has a doubt about global warming is a libertarian right-wing nutter.
I hope people don't read us that way.
Oh, you didn't say nutter. I said nutter.
I'm not a... Yes, we don't use that word very much in the U.S.
Don't you?
No. I have British friends that use it, but it's not a common American term.
Oh, okay.
I hope people don't read us that way, because our goal was to explain one of the ideological roots of what has increasingly become a huge problem in the U.S., in which we have one political party that rejects mainstream science on a great many issues. It was not our goal to assert that, well, everyone that doesn't believe in global warming catastrophe is a right-wing nutter, I think was your term.
Yes, you're learning. Nutter.
Yeah, nutter. I don't pronounce it right. but at the same time, there is a core of skeptics who have been shown to be wrong many times and don't change their minds.
Yeah, but there are left-wing nutters who don't change their minds either.
Yeah, that's true.
Look, I really...
So in other words, I'm arguing for moderation in all things.
In all things. which brings us in a way to Rachel Carson and the DDT story, because it doesn't necessarily fit into the rest of the flow of your book, but it's a very revealing window.
Yeah.
Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring, advocating moderation in the use of DDT. This led to a ban on DDT. And now we have what you call revisionists saying Rachel Carson was a mass murderer because millions of people have died from malaria because DDT wasn't used. QED, they should never have banned DDT. And you shouldn't ban things and you shouldn't regulate things. And it was an enviro-socialist mad thing. What do you say?
That
you say DDT
has
ceased to be effective.
Well, so
already.
So one of the reasons it was bannable in the U.S. is it was becoming ineffective because of the pesticide abuse. What happens is insects evolve very rapidly because they have such short generation times. If you wipe out 99% of all the mosquitoes, say with DDT, then the only survivors are the ones that were resistant. So the very next generation it develops resistance. In a period of about a dozen years, large chunks of the U.S. DDT stopped working, and that eventually enabled the ban. It wasn't just Rachel Carson, in other words. The second part of that story that's told by the right-wingers in the United States, though, is simply bogusly false. The U.S. banned DDT. Africa didn't. It's still in use there. It's not used in large-scale spraying campaigns to prevent the evolution of this resistance. It's what's called indoor residual spraying. They literally spray it around the insides of doors and windows because DDT works as a repellent. More recently, we found ways of embedding DDT into bed nets so that will simply be put over on top of things. So blaming Rachel Carson for the deaths of millions of Africans from the banning of DDT is simply historically wrong because it was never ban
it's such
in
a,
Africa.
It's clearly...
It's a bogus story.
But it's clearly a compelling story.
It is.
Because it is widespread.
Mm-hmm.
And to portray the mother of the environmental movement as a mass murderer is too good to go past for a certain spectrum.
And notice that the journalist parroting that story didn't bother to check the basic fact of whether it had been banned or not.
Mm. So this is your answer to the fairness doctrine or the balance... you let people talk, but the journalist has to be so fully armed that they might have spent a lifetime studying the IPCC documents, mm-hmm. that everybody's credibility can be checked and revealed. Now, that's not realistic.
No, and we know it's not realistic. And our problem as historians is we see this problem happening, but we don't know how to fix it either. In the U.S. anyway, science reporting as a discipline is going away. The newsrooms are cutting out the specialized science reporters and replacing them with political reporters. And that simply makes science reporting even worse because it tends to reinforce the he said, she said nature of that discipline.
That's right.
That's a tragedy. I think it's going to be a tragedy for us as a society. But at the same time, we don't quite know how to fix it. It's been suggested to us by Bud Ward, who runs one of the major programs in education, journalist education programs in the United States, that the norm of balance should go away and be replaced with a norm of accuracy. Sounds like a good idea, but I don't quite know where the resources your profession will find the resources in order to do that.
I'm not sure what accuracy you mean. As soon as you start talking about accuracy,
now you're starting to have to actually check lots of independent things. I mean, that's in the end.
But there are always areas of doubt, and
yes.
Your book is entitled Merchants of Doubt.
Yes, there are.
And if you are trying to undermine an argument, you will always head for that soft underbelly of doubt,
mm-hmm.
and you will blow it up,
mm-hmm.
and you will say this area of doubt means that nothing is true. That's the way it works.
That's the common meaning of error and uncertainty is that we don't know anything, but that's not the way scientists use those terms. And so one of the problems that we foresee is simply that because science journalists will go away, the journalists that replace them, the political journalists, will not understand that to a scientist in every measurement has some amount of error in it from the instrument inaccuracy. That doesn't make the measurement wrong. It just means it's imprecise.
Mm. What are you moving on to? Is there another book in the pipeline, or are you carrying on mining a number of documents that you have unearthed as a result of writing this one?
We don't right now have a plan for another book.
Singer in Sight still alive, by the way?
Singer is.
Did you
He's
talk to
the
him?
Last of the four. No.
Did you try to talk to him?
No.
Why not?
We didn't attempt to talk to him because one of the realities of this, of a really difficult subject like this, is that people can sue you to prevent publication of your work if they know it's coming. That's happened to some other historians. So we work from documents and from published material, but we didn't interview too many people for the book.
That's a shame in a way, because one would have really liked to know what Fred Singer would have said,
mm-hmm.
if these involvements had been put to him with what is now the wisdom of hindsight. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
How could you possibly defend this, knowing what you know now, is the question you would put to him.
There are plenty of interviews with him by other journalists who have done that sort of thing.
And what does he say?
And we can mine those. His answer is always that he believes his work, that he really does think that the rest of the science community is perverted, and he's right. He's got a book out now on how, what is it called? 1,500 years of global warming that's inevitable and natural, which he bases on a thing called the Danskord Usher events that used to occur during the Ice Ages and don't anymore.
You've looked into this theory?
Yes. The thing is that they occurred during the Ice Ages due to the presence of the Laurentide Ice Sheet, but that hasn't existed in 10,000 years. And so he's projecting forward, I believe, a happening that used to occur and doesn't, because we believe he needs to believe that this is all a set of natural cycles. He had a similar sort of eccentric? No, an eccentric idea with the ozone hole, too,
yeah.
that really the ozone hole was a natural phenomenon that just hadn't been seen before. And he published an article in EOS, the newsletter, the American Geophysical Union on that back, I believe, in 87 or 88.
So have you heard from him or his lawyers since this book came out?
We've heard from him. He published a piece in American Thinker attacking us with a very silly error at its root. He accuses us of believing that oxygen 15 is created by burning of cigarettes, and he wanted to know how that happened, and that was our assertion for how tobacco causes cancer. The problem is that what we actually did was quote his fellow doubtmonger Fred Seitz on the subject. It wasn't our assertion, it was his.
I see. I could take you quite a lot of time to argue your way through that one.
Yes.
It's been very nice talking to you. Thank you, Eric Conway, who, with Naomi Oreskes, has written a book called Merchants of Doubt, the subtitle says it all, how a handful of scientists obscured the truth on issues from tobacco smoke to global warming.